The Marching Season, Disc 3.
9. London. How long will you be staying in the United Kingdom? The officer in the passport control booth asked rapturously. Just a day. Michael Osborne handed over his passport, which bore his real name because the agency had taken back his false passports upon his retirement, at least the ones they knew about. Over the years, several friendly intelligence services had also granted him passports out of professional courtesy. He could travel as a Spaniard, an Italian, an Israeli, or a Frenchman. He even had obtained an Egyptian passport from an asset inside that country's intelligence service, which permitted him to enter certain Middle Eastern countries as a fellow Arab, rather than an outsider. None of those intelligence services had asked for their passports after Michael's departure from the secret world. They were locked in Douglas Cannon's safe on Shelter Island. The inspection of his passport was taking longer than usual. Obviously, it had been flagged by the British security services. The last time Michael was in England, he had been caught in the middle of the Sword of Gaza's attack at Heathrow Airport. He had also conducted an unauthorized meeting with a man named Ivan Drozdov, a KGB defector under the care of MI6, who was murdered later that afternoon. "Where are you staying in the United Kingdom?" the officer asked tonelessly, reading from the small computer screen in front of him. "In London," Michael said. The officer looked up. "Where in London, Mr. Osborne?" Michael gave the officer the address of a hotel in Knightsbridge, which he dutifully wrote down. Michael knew the officer would give the address to his supervisor, and the supervisor would give it to Britain's Internal Security Service, MI5. "Do you have a reservation at your hotel, Mr. Osborne?" "Yes, I do." "Is it in your name?" "Yes." The officer handed back the passport. "Enjoy your stay." Michael picked up his slender garment bag, passed through customs, and entered the arrival hall. He had telephoned his old London car service from the plane. He scanned the waiting crowd, looking for his driver, and instinctively any sign of surveillance. A familiar face, a figure that seemed somehow out of place, a set of eyes watching him. He spotted a small limousine driver in a dark suit holding a cardboard sign that said, "Mr. Stafford." Michael crossed the hall and said, "Let's go." "Take your bag, sir?" "No, thanks." Michael slumped down in the back seat of the Rover sedan as it crawled through the thick morning traffic toward the West End. The motorway had given way to the Edwardian facades of the hotels along the Cromwell Road. Michael knew London all too well. He had lived in a flat in Chelsea for more than 10 years when he was working in the field. Most CIA officers stationed abroad work from embassies with diplomatic jobs for cover. But Michael had worked in counterterrorism, recruiting and running agents in the terrorist playgrounds of Europe and the Middle East. An assignment like that was next to impossible under diplomatic cover. So Michael had operated as an NOC, which in the lexicon of the agency meant he had non-official cover. He posed as a salesman for a company that designed computer systems for businesses. The company was a CIA front, but the job permitted Michael to travel throughout Europe and the Middle East without suspicion. Michael's control officer, Adrian Carter, used to say that if there was ever a man born and bred to spy, it was Michael Osborne. His father had worked for the OSS during the war and then entered the clandestine service of its successor, the CIA. Michael and his mother, Alexandra, followed him from posting to posting, Rome, Beirut, Athens, Belgrade, and Madrid, with short tours at headquarters in between. While his father was running Russian spies, Michael and his mother absorbed languages and culture. Michael's dark skin and hair allowed him to pass for an Italian or a Spaniard or even a certain type of Lebanese Arab. He used to test himself in markets and cafes to see how long he could go without being recognized as an outsider. He spoke Italian with a Roman accent and Spanish like a native of Madrid. He struggled a bit with Greek, but mastered Arabic so thoroughly the shopkeepers in Beirut's souk assumed he was Lebanese and didn't cheat him. The car arrived at the hotel. Michael paid off the driver and got out. It was a small hotel with no doorman and no concierge, just a pretty Polish girl behind an oak desk with keys hanging on pegs behind her. He checked in and asked for a 2 p.m. wake-up call. Retirement had not robbed Michael of a healthy professional paranoia. For 5 minutes he inspected the room, turning over lamps, opening closet doors, tearing apart the telephone, and then carefully reassembling it. He had performed the same ritual in 1,000 hotel rooms in 100 different cities. Only once had he ever found a bug, a Soviet-made museum piece crudely attached to the telephone of a hotel room in Damascus. His search turned up nothing. He turned on the television and watched the morning news on the BBC. Northern Ireland Secretary Mo Mollem has vowed that the new Protestant paramilitary group, the Ulster Freedom Brigade, will never be allowed to destroy the Good Friday Accords. She has called on the chief constable of the IUC, Ronnie Flanagan, to redouble his efforts to capture the leaders of the terrorist group. Michael shut off the television and closed his eyes, still dressed in the clothes he had worn on the flight. He slept fitfully, wrestling with his blanket, sweating in his clothing, until the telephone screamed. For an instant he thought he had been transported behind the Iron Curtain, but it was only the flaxen-haired Polish girl at the front desk, gently informing him it was 2 o'clock. He ordered coffee, showered, and dressed in jeans, bucks, black mock turtleneck sweater, and blue blazer. He hung the Do Not Disturb sign on the doorknob and left a telltale in the jam. Outside, the sky was the color of gunpowder, and cold wind bent the trees in Hyde Park. He turned up the collar of his overcoat, knotted the scarf at his throat, and he started walking, first along Knightsbridge, then the Brompton Road. He spotted the first watcher, balding, mid-40s, leather jacket, stubble on his chin. Anonymous, ordinary, unthreatening, perfect for pavement work. He ate an omelette in a French café in the Brompton Road and read the Evening Standard. A leader of the Muslim fundamentalist group Hamas had been assassinated in Egypt. Michael read the article once, then read it a second time, and thought about it some more as he walked to Harrods. The balding watcher was gone, and a new one was in his place, same model but wearing a forest green barber coat instead of a leather jacket. He entered Harrods, paid an obligatory visit to the shrine to Dodi and Diana, and then took the escalator up. The man in the barber jacket followed him. He purchased a Scottish sweater for Douglas and a pair of earrings for Elizabeth. He went downstairs again and meandered through the food hall. A new watcher was trailing him, a rather attractive young woman in jeans, combat-style boots, and a tan quilted jacket. Night had fallen, and with it came a wind-blown rain. He left the Harrods bag at the desk of his hotel and flagged down a taxi. For the next hour and a half he moved restlessly about the West End, by taxi, underground, and bus, through Belgravia, Mayfair, Westminster, and finally Sloane Square. He walked south until he reached Chelsea Embankment. He stood in the rain, looking at the lights of Chelsea Bridge. It had been more than 10 years since the night Sarah Randolph was shot on this spot, but the image of her death played out in his thoughts as if it were on videotape. He saw her walking toward him, long skirt dancing across buckskin boots, the embankment shining with river mist. Then the man appeared, the black-haired man with brilliant blue eyes and a silenced automatic, the KGB assassin Michael knew only as October, the same man who had tried to murder Michael and Elizabeth on Shelter Island. Michael closed his eyes as Sarah's exploding face flashed through his thoughts. The agency had assured him that October was dead. But now, after reading the account of the assassination of Ahmed Hussein in Cairo, he was not so certain. "I think I'm being followed," Michael said, standing in the window overlooking Eaton Place. "You are being followed," Graham Seymour said. "The department flagged your passport. You were a very naughty boy the last time you paid a visit to our fair island. We picked you up this morning at Heathrow." Michael accepted a tumbler of scotch from Graham and sat down in the wing chair next to the fire. Graham Seymour opened an ebony cigarette box on the coffee table and took out 2 Dunhills, one for himself and one for Michael. They sat in silence, 2 old chums who have told each other every story they know and are content just to sit in each other's presence. Vivaldi played softly on Graham's elaborate German sound system. Graham closed his gray eyes and savored his cigarette and whiskey. Graham Seymour worked for the counterterrorism division of MI5. Like Michael, he had been a child prodigy. His father had worked closely with John Masterman in the double-cross operation of MI5 during the war, capturing German spies and playing them back against their masters at the Abwehr in Berlin. He had stayed on with MI5 after the war and worked against the Russians. Harold Seymour was a legend, and his son was forever bumping into his memory at headquarters and running across his exploits in old case files. Michael understood the pressure this placed on Graham because he had experienced the same thing in the agency. The two men had developed a friendship when Michael was based in London. They had shared information from time to time and watched each other's back. Still, friendships have well-defined limits in the intelligence business, and Michael maintained a healthy professional mistrust of Graham Seymour. He knew Graham would stab him in the back if MI5 ordered him to do so. "Is it all right for you to be seen with a leper like me?" Michael asked.
"Dinner with an old friend, darling. No harm in that. Besides, I plan to feed them some good gossip about the inner workings of Langley."
"I haven't set foot in Langley in over a year."
"No one ever really retires from this business. The department hounded my father till the day he died. Every time something special came up, they sent a couple of nice men round to sit at the feet of the Great Harold."
Michael raised his glass and said, "To the Great Harold."
"Hear, hear."
Graham drank some of the whiskey.
"So how is retirement, anyway?"
"It sucks."
"Really?"
"Yes, really," Michael said. "It was all right for a while, especially when I was recovering. But after a while I started to go stir-crazy. I tried to write my book, then decided writing one's memoirs at 48 was an exercise in extreme self-absorption. So I read other people's books, I putter, and I take long walks in Manhattan."
"What about the children?"
Graham asked this question with the skepticism of a man who had elevated childlessness to a religion.
"What's it like being a father for the first time at your age?"
"What the hell do you mean by your age?"
"I mean you're 48 years old, love. The first time you try to play a set of tennis with your children, you may very well drop dead of a coronary."
"It's marvelous," Michael said. "It's the best thing I've ever done."
"But?"
Graham wondered.
"But I'm cooped up in the apartment with the children all day, and I'm beginning to go a bit insane."
"So, what are you planning to do with the rest of your life?"
"Develop a drinking problem. More scotch, please."
"Absolutely," Graham said. He made a vast show of snatching up the bottle with his long hands and dumping an inch of the whiskey into Michael's glass. Graham had a deftness about him, a shocking, uncontrived grace, even in the simplest gesture. Michael thought he was a little too pretty for a spy. The half-closed gray eyes, the projected bored insolence, the narrow features that would have been attractive on a woman's face. He was an artist at heart, a gifted pianist who could have made his living on the concert stage instead of the secret stage, had he chosen to do so. Michael assumed it was his father's wartime heroics, his bloody wonderful war, Graham snarled once after too much Bordeaux, that drove Graham into intelligence work. Graham said, "So when the senator asked you to do a little freelance work on the Ulster Freedom Brigade, I didn't exactly stomp my feet and resist. Did Elizabeth see through your little game?"
"Elizabeth sees through everything. She's a lawyer, remember, and a damned good one. She would have made an excellent intelligence officer, too."
Michael hesitated for a moment. "So, what can you tell me about the Ulster Freedom Brigade?"
"Precious little, I'm afraid."
Graham hesitated.
"Usual rules for the game, right, Michael? Any information I give you is for your background purposes only. You may not share it with any member of your former service, or any other service for that matter."
Michael raised his right hand and said, "Scout's honor." Graham spoke for 20 minutes without interruption. The British intelligence and security organizations were not certain whether the Ulster Freedom Brigade had 5 members or 500. Hundreds of known members of Protestant paramilitary organizations had been interrogated, and none had provided a single useful lead. The sophistication of the attack suggested the group had expertise and serious financial backing. There was also evidence to suggest that its leaders would go to extraordinary lengths to safeguard internal security. Charlie Bates, a Protestant suspected in the murder of Eamon Dillon, had been discovered shot to death in a barn outside Hillsborough in County Armagh, and the bombers in Dublin and London had both died in the explosions, a fact that had not been made public. "This is Northern Ireland, not West Beirut," Graham said. "The Northern Irish aren't suicide bombers. It's simply not part of the fabric of the conflict." So the leaders of the Ulster Freedom Brigade recruit action agents with no known paramilitary connections, and then make certain they die so no one is left behind to talk. "That would appear to be the case," Graham said. "So what is this Ulster Freedom Brigade trying to accomplish?" "If we take them at their word, they're out to destroy the peace process. If we judge them by their actions, they are not going to be content to just kill off a few ordinary Catholics, like their Protestant brethren in the Loyalist Volunteer Force. They've demonstrated their willingness to attack high-profile soft targets and shed innocent blood. It looks to me as though they're out to punish all parties to the peace process." "Exactly," Graham said. "The Irish government, the British government, Sinn Féin. And I think the leaders of the Protestant parties who signed the agreement had better watch their back as well." "What about the Americans?" "Your Senator George Mitchell brokered the Good Friday Agreement, and the Protestant hardliners have never been too fond of the Americans. They think you've clearly sided with the Catholics and want the North to be united with the Irish Republic." "So the American ambassador to London would have to consider himself a potential target." "The Ulster Freedom Brigade has demonstrated quite clearly that they have the will and the expertise to carry out spectacular acts of terrorism. Given their accomplishments thus far, taking out an American ambassador would seem to be a reasonable proposition." An hour later, they met Graham's wife, Helen, at a French restaurant called Marcello's in Covent Garden. Helen wore black, a tight-fitting black sweater, a short black skirt, black stockings, black shoes with impossibly thick heels. She went through phases like a teenage girl. The last time Michael was in London, Helen had been in the midst of her Mediterranean period. She had dressed like a Greek peasant and cooked only with olive oil. After a long absence from the workforce, she had recently taken a job as art director for a successful publishing house. Her new job came with a coveted space in the company car park. She had commandeered Graham's BMW and insisted on driving to work each morning, listening to her ghastly alternative rock CDs and screaming at her mother over her mobile phone, even though the trip would take half the time by tube. She was the kind of wife who turned heads at personnel. Graham indulged her because she was beautiful and because she was gifted. She possessed a fire for life that the service had long ago extinguished in him. He wore her like a loud tie. Helen was already seated at a table next to the window, drinking Sancerre. She rose, kissed Michael's cheek, and held him tightly for a moment. "God, it's marvelous to see you, Michael." Marcello appeared, all smiles and bonhomie, and poured wine for Michael and Graham. "Don't bother looking at the menu," Helen said, "because I've already ordered for you." Graham and Michael quietly closed their menus and surrendered them without protest. Helen's return to the workforce had left her no time to pursue her great passion, which was cooking. Unfortunately, her talent ended at the doorway to her 50,000-pound modern Scandinavian kitchen. Now she and Graham ate only in restaurants. Michael noticed that Graham was beginning to put on weight. Helen spoke of her own work because she knew Michael and Graham could not speak of theirs. "I'm trying to finish the cover for a new thriller," Helen said. "Some beastly American who writes about serial killers. How many different ways can you illustrate a serial killer? I produce a cover, we send it across the Atlantic, and the agent in New York rejects it. So bloody frustrating sometimes." She looked at Michael, and her bright green eyes turned suddenly serious. "My God, I'm being such a crashing bore. How's Elizabeth?" Michael looked at Graham. He gave a nearly imperceptible nod. Graham routinely flaunted the regulations of the security service by telling Helen too much about his work. "Some days are better than others," Michael said. "But overall, she's doing fine. We've turned the apartment and the Shelter Island house into fortresses. It helps her sleep better at night. and then there are the children. Between her work and the twins, she has little time to dwell on the past.
Did she really kill that German woman? Oh, God, Graham, what was her name again?
Astrid Vogel, Graham put in.
Did she really do it with a bow and arrow?
Michael nodded.
My God, Helen murmured. What happened?
Astrid Vogel followed her into the guest cottage where you and Graham stayed a couple of years ago. Elizabeth hid in the bedroom closet. One of her old bows was there. She was a champion archer when she was a girl, just like her father. She did what she had to do to survive.
What happened to the other assassin, this October fellow?
The agency received reports through channels it trusted that October is dead, that he'd been killed by the men who hired him to kill me because he had failed.
Do you believe it? Helen asked.
I thought it was remotely possible once, Michael said. But now I don't believe it at all. In fact, I'm almost certain October is alive and working again. This assassination in Cairo, Ahmed Hussein, Graham put in for Helen's benefit. I've read the eyewitness accounts carefully. I can't explain it, but it just feels like him.
Didn't October always shoot his victims in the face?
He did, but if he's supposed to be dead, it makes sense that he would have to alter his signature.
What do you plan to do? Graham asked.
I'm booked on the first flight to Cairo tomorrow morning. Ten. Cairo. Michael arrived in Cairo early the following afternoon. As in Britain, he entered the country on his true passport and was granted a 2-week tourist visa. He sliced his way through the madness of the airport arrival lounge, past Bedouins with all their worldly possessions crammed inside wilting cardboard boxes, past a bleating cluster of goats, and waited 20 minutes at the taxi stand for a rattletrap Lada sedan. He smoked cigarettes to cover the stench of exhaust pouring into the back seat. Michael found Cairo intolerably hot in summer, but the winters were remarkably pleasant. The air was warm and soft, and a desert wind chased puffy white clouds around an azure sky. The road from the airport was jammed with poor Egyptians trying to take some pleasure in the good weather. Entire families sprawled in the grassy median around picnic lunches. The taxi driver spoke to Michael in English, but Michael wanted to see whether his skills had atrophied, so he answered him in rapid Arabic. He told the driver he was a Lebanese businessman living in London who had fled Beirut during the war. For a half hour they talked of Beirut in the old days, Michael in flawless Beirut-accented Arabic, the driver in the accent of his Nile Delta village. Michael was bored with the Nile Hilton and sick of the turmoil of Tahrir Square, so he took a room at the Intercontinental, a sandstone-colored edifice looming over the corniche that, like all newer buildings in Cairo, bore the scars of dust and diesel fumes. He lay by the rooftop pool, drinking warm Egyptian beer, his mind flowing from one thought to the next, until the sun vanished into the western desert and the evening call to prayer started up. First one muezzin a very long way off, then another and another, until 1,000 recorded voices screamed in concert. He forced himself out of his chaise longue and went to the railing overlooking the river. A few faithful drifted toward the mosques, but mostly Cairo continued to churn beneath him. At 5 o'clock he went to his room, showered, and dressed. He took a taxi a short distance up the river to a restaurant called Paprika, next to the towering headquarters of the state-run Egyptian television network. Paprika was the equivalent of Joe Allen in New York, a place where actors and writers came to be seen by each other and by Egyptians wealthy enough to afford the rather mediocre food. One side of the restaurant overlooked the parking lot of Egyptian television. These were the most coveted tables in the restaurant because sometimes patrons caught a glimpse of an actor or celebrity or senior government official. Michael had reserved a table on the unfashionable side of the restaurant. He drank bottled water and watched the sun setting over the Nile, and thought of the first agent he had ever recruited, a Syrian intelligence officer based in London who had a taste for English girls and good champagne. The agency suspected the Syrian was siphoning some of his operating funds to support his habits. Michael approached the officer, threatened to expose him to his superiors in Damascus, and coerced him into becoming a paid spy for the CIA. The agent provided valuable intelligence on Syrian support for several different terrorist groups, Arab and European. 2 years after his recruitment, he provided his most valuable piece of information. A PLO terror cell had set up shop in Frankfurt, where it was planning to bomb a nightclub frequented by American servicemen. Michael passed the information to headquarters, and headquarters tipped off the West German police, who arrested the Palestinians. The Syrian was paid $100,000 for the information, and Michael was awarded the Distinguished Intelligence Medal during a secret ceremony. The medal had to be locked away in a file cabinet at headquarters. Youssef Hafez entered the restaurant. Unlike the Syrian, Hafez had come to the agency voluntarily rather than through coercion. He had the fleshy good looks of an aging film star, black hair gone to gray, square features gone soft with 20 extra pounds, deep fissures around his eyes when he smiled. Hafez was a colonel in the Mukhabarat, the Egyptian intelligence service, and his job was to combat Egypt's Islamic fundamentalist rebels, the Al-Gama'at Ismailia. He had personally captured and tortured several of its leaders. Cairo Station had recruited Hafez, but he refused to work with Cairo-based officers because their movements were monitored so closely by his own service. Michael had been assigned to the case. Hafez had provided a steady stream of information on the state of the Islamic revolt in Egypt and the movement of Egyptian terrorists around the globe. In return, he was paid handsomely, money that helped defray the costs of his relentless womanizing. Hafez liked younger women, and they liked him. He believed he was doing nothing to endanger his country, and therefore he felt no guilt. He spoke to Michael in Arabic, loudly enough so that the diners at surrounding tables could hear him, and Michael followed suit. He asked Michael what brought him to town, and Michael said business interests in Cairo and Alexandria. The restaurant buzzed for a moment as a famous Egyptian actress climbed out of her car and walked inside the television building. "Why paprika?" Michael asked. "I thought Arabesque was your favorite restaurant." "It is, but I'm meeting someone here when we're finished." "What's her name?"
"Calls herself Cassandra. Comes from a Greek family in Alexandria. She's the most gorgeous creature I've ever seen. She plays a minor character in Egyptian television drama, a little bitch who's always causing trouble, within the confines of our strict Islamic morals, of course."
The waiter came over to the table.
"I'm going to have some whiskey before we eat. What about you, Michael?"
"Beer, please.
One Johnny Walker Black on the rocks, one Stella."
The waiter vanished. Michael said, "How old is she?"
22, Hafez said proudly.
The drinks came. Hafez raised his Johnny Walker.
"Cheers."
Hafez was the Muslim equivalent of a lapsed Catholic. He had no quarrel with his religion, and its rituals and ceremonies provided him the comfort of a childhood blanket. But he ignored anything in the Koran that got in the way of his enjoyment of worldly things. He also worked most Fridays, the Muslim Sabbath, because his job required that he monitor the sermons of Egypt's more radical sheikhs.
"Does she know what you do for a living?"
"I tell her I import Mercedes automobiles into Egypt, which accounts for my well-appointed love nest on Zamalek."
He nodded toward the river. Zamalek was a long, slender island, removed from the madness of central Cairo, filled with expensive shops and restaurants and fashionable apartment houses. If Hafez was keeping a mistress on Zamalek, a television actress, no less, he had blackmailed his new case officer into a significant increase in salary.
"Ah, there she is now."
Michael turned discreetly toward the door of the restaurant. A woman who looked remarkably like Sophia Loren walked through the door on the arm of a young man with oiled hair and sunglasses. They ordered dinner. Hafez sent a bottle of expensive French champagne to Sophia Loren's table.
Michael was paying, he always paid. You don't mind, do you, Michael? Fez asked. Of course not. So, what brings you to Cairo, besides a chance to have dinner with a debauched old friend?
The murder of Ahmed Hussein. Hafez tilted his head slightly as if to say, these things happen.
Michael said, were the Egyptian security services involved in his murder?
Absolutely not, Hafez said. We don't engage in such behavior.
Michael rolled his eyes and said, do you know who was behind the assassination?
The Israelis, of course.
How can you be so sure?
Because we were watching the Israelis watching Hussein.
Back up, Michael said. Start at the beginning.
2 weeks ago, an Israeli team arrived in Cairo on various European passports and set up a static observation post in a flat in Ma'adi. We set up a static post in the flat across the street.
How do you know they were Israelis?
Please, Michael, give us a little credit. Oh, they could pass as Egyptians, but they were definitely Israelis. They used to be good, the Mossad, but now they sometimes act like a bunch of bumbling amateurs. In the old days, they could attract the best, every spy a prince and all that bullshit. Now the bright boys want to make money and talk on their mobile phones in Ben Yehuda Street. Let me tell you, Michael, if Moses had these people spying for him, the Jews would never have made it out of Sinai.
You've made your point, Yusuf. Go on.
They were clearly watching Hussein, monitoring his movements, photographic surveillance, audio coverage, the usual. We took the opportunity to engage in a little counter-surveillance. As a result, we have a nice photo album of 6 Mossad agents, 4 men, 2 women. Interested?
Talk to your real case officer.
I also have a videotape of Hussein's death.
What?
You heard me, Hafez said. Every time he set foot outside his flat, we rolled the video cameras. We were rolling when the gunman on the motorcycle killed him on the steps of the mosque.
Jesus Christ.
I have a copy of the tape in my briefcase.
I want to see it.
You can have the fucking thing, Michael, no charge.
I want to see it now.
Please, Michael, Hafez said. The tape's not going to disappear. Besides, I'm famished, and the veal here is excellent.
45 minutes later, they entered the Egyptian television building. Michael, Hafez, and Cassandra. She escorted them to the newsroom and showed them into a small edit room. Hafez dug the video cassette from his briefcase and loaded it into a playback deck. Cassandra stepped out and closed the door, leaving behind the scent of sandalwood oil. Hafez smoked until the edit room felt like a gas chamber and Michael begged him to stop. Michael watched the tape 3 times at normal speed and 3 more in slow motion. He pushed the eject button and clutched the tape in his hand. Hafez said, he's damned good with a gun, that fellow. Not many people in the world could make that shot and get away.
He's extremely good with a gun. Do you know who he is?
Unfortunately, I think I do. 11. Belfast. The Ulster Unionist Party is headquartered in a 4-story building at No. 3 Glengall Street, near the Europa Hotel and the Grand Opera House. Because of its location on the western edge of the city center near the Falls Road, the UUP headquarters was a frequent target of IRA attacks throughout the Troubles. But the IRA was abiding by the ceasefire for now. And so the man in the silver Vauxhall sedan felt little apprehension as he headed toward Glengall Street through the early morning rain. Ian Morris was one of 4 vice presidents of the Ulster Unionist Council, the party's central committee. He had Ulster loyalism in his blood. His great-grandfather had earned his fortune in linen during the industrial boom in Belfast in the 19th century and built a large estate in the Forth River Valley overlooking the slums of West Belfast. In 1912, when the original Ulster Volunteer Force formed up to fight Irish Home Rule, Morris's ancestor allowed guns and supplies to be hidden in the stables and wooded gardens of the estate. Morris had no financial concerns as a young man. His great-grandfather's fortune provided him with a comfortable income, and he had planned a career in academia after graduating from Cambridge. But the Troubles got its hooks into him, the way it had so many men of his generation on both sides of Ulster's religious divide, and he turned to violence instead. He joined the Ulster Volunteer Force and spent 5 years in the Mays prison for bombing a Catholic pub on the Broadway. In prison, he had decided to turn away from the gun and the bomb and campaign for peace. Now there was little about his demeanor to suggest that Ian Morris had ever been a part of Northern Ireland's terrorist underworld. His home in the Castlereagh section of East Belfast was a sanctuary of books. He spoke Latin, Greek, and Irish, unusual for a Protestant, since most considered Irish the language of Catholics. As he drove along the Castlereagh Road through the steady rain, Mozart's Piano Concerto in D minor, performed by Alfred Brendel, played softly from the Vauxhall sound system. He turned into May Street and passed Belfast City Hall at Donegal Square. At Brunswick Street, a van in front of him appeared to stall. Morris gave a short, polite beep of his horn, but the van remained stationary. He had a staff meeting at 9, and he was running late. He pressed the horn a second time, but the van still did not move. Morris shut off the Mozart. Ahead of him, he saw the offside door open and a leather-jacketed man emerge. Morris let down his window, but the man in the leather jacket stepped directly in front of the Vauxhall and withdrew a large-caliber pistol. Shortly before noon, the newsroom of the Belfast Telegraph was in bedlam. The staff of Northern Ireland's most important newspaper was putting together extensive coverage of the assassination of Ian Morris. A main story, a sidebar on Morris's career with the Ulster Unionist Party and the UVF, and an analysis of the state of the peace process. All that was missing was a claim of responsibility. At 12:05 p.m., a telephone on the news desk rattled. A junior news editor called Clark answered it. "Telegraph newsroom," Clark shouted over the din. "Pay attention, because I'm only going to say this once," the caller said. Male, calm, authoritative, Clark noted. "This is a representative of the Ulster Freedom Brigade. A brigade officer under orders from the Brigade Military Council carried out the assassination of Ian Morris earlier today. The Ulster Unionists have betrayed the Protestant people of Northern Ireland by supporting the Good Friday Accords. The Ulster Freedom Brigade will continue its campaign until the Good Friday Agreement is nullified." The caller paused, then said, "Did you get that?"
"Got it."
"Good," the voice said, and the line went dead. Clark stood at his desk and shouted, "We have a claim for Ian Morris."
"Who is it?"
came a shout from somewhere in the newsroom.
"Ulster Freedom Brigade," Clark said. "My God, it's prods killing prods."
12. Shelter Island, New York. Elizabeth met Michael outside the British Airways terminal at Kennedy Airport. His body ached from travel, 3 very long flights in 3 days, and for the first time in many weeks, he could feel the pulling of the scar tissue in his chest. His mouth was sour from too many cigarettes and too much airline coffee. When Elizabeth flung her arms about his body, he gave her only a brief kiss below her ear. He was really too tired to drive, but he feared inactivity more. He placed his bag into the rear storage compartment next to a half dozen packages of diapers and a case of Similac, and climbed behind the wheel.
"You look like you got some sun, Michael," Elizabeth said as Michael entered the Van Wyck Expressway.
Michael switched on the radio, turning the dial from Elizabeth's adult contemporary rock station to WCBS so he could listen to the traffic updates.
"Must have been quite a warm spell in London while you were there."
"I wasn't in London the entire time."
"Oh, really?" she said. "Where the hell were you?"
"I stopped in Cairo for a day."
"You stopped in Cairo for a day? What the hell does Cairo have to do with Northern Ireland?"
"Nothing," he said. "I needed to see an old friend about something."
"What?"
Michael hesitated.
"You don't work for them anymore, so you can't hide behind their regulations," she said icily. "I'd like to know why you went to Cairo."
"Can we talk about this later?" he said. This was code for "I don't want to quarrel in front of the nanny who was in the back seat with the children."
"You have that look, Michael. that look you used to have when you came home from the field and couldn't tell me where you'd been or what you'd been doing.
I'm going to tell you everything, just not now.
Well, I'm glad you're back, darling, Elizabeth said, looking away again. You look wonderful, by the way. You always did look nice with a tan.
Douglas was already asleep when they reached the island. Elizabeth and the nanny put the children down. Michael went to their bedroom and unpacked. His hair smelled of Cairo, diesel, dust, and wood smoke, so he showered. When he came back into the bedroom, Elizabeth was seated at her dressing table, pulling earrings from her ears and rings from her fingers. He remembered a time when she would sit at her dressing table for an hour, taking pleasure in her appearance and her ability to make it more perfect. Now she worked quickly and without joy, like an assembly line worker. Since his retirement, Michael did nothing quickly. Haste in others mystified him.
"Why did you go to Cairo?"
Elizabeth said, violently brushing her hair.
"Because a leader of Hamas was assassinated there a couple of days ago."
"Ahmed Hussein," she said. "I read about it in the Times.
There was something about the way the job was carried out that intrigued me, so I went and knocked on a few old doors."
He told her of his meeting with Youssef Hafez. He told her of the Mossad team and the Egyptian counter-surveillance. Then he told her about the videotape.
"I want to see it," she said.
"A man gets shot to death, Elizabeth. It's not make-believe."
"I've seen people shot before."
He inserted the tape into the VCR. A street scene appeared on the screen, robed men streaming from a mosque. A few seconds later, a motorcycle roared into the frame at high speed. The motorcyclist stopped suddenly at the steps of the mosque, and his arm swung up. He fired several times, the silenced handgun emitting no discernible sound. The shot struck a small bearded man, turning his white robe crimson with blood. The man on the motorcycle fired twice more, shooting a second man in the chest and a third through the throat. The engine roared again, and the gunman vanished into traffic. Michael stopped the tape.
"Jesus Christ," Elizabeth said softly.
"I think it may be him," Michael said. "I think it's October."
"How can you tell?"
"I've seen him move. I've seen him handle a gun. The way his arm swings before he fires, it's very distinctive."
"He's wearing a helmet, so he can't see his face. The tape proves nothing."
"Maybe, maybe not." Michael rewound the tape. Ahmed Hussein was alive again. The motorcycle swept into the frame and skidded to a stop. The assassin's arm swung up. Michael froze the image of the killer, leveling his gun at his first victim, arm straight out from his side. Then he walked to the closet, opened the doors, and took down a small box from the top shelf. He opened the box and pulled out a gun.
"What the hell is that?"
"It's his gun," Michael said, "the one he dropped in the water off the dock that night. It's a Beretta 9mm competition pistol. I'm not sure, but I think it's the same kind of gun used by the killer in Cairo."
"That's still hardly conclusive evidence," Elizabeth said.
"He dropped the gun because I shot him in the hand."
Michael tapped the television screen. "His right hand, the hand we can see holding the gun."
"What's your point, Michael?"
"I shot him with a high-powered Browning automatic. The round probably tore through his hand, broke bones, left an ugly scar. If I find a scar on that hand, I'll be certain it's him."
"It's awfully far away to see something as small as a scar."
"The agency has computers capable of bringing out the smallest detail in videotape images. I want to run this tape through those computers and see if there's anything there."
Elizabeth stood up and switched off the television. "So what if that's him? So what if he's still alive and killing people again? What difference does it make to us?"
"I just want to know."
"He can't hurt us. You and your friends at the agency turned this place into a fortress, and don't pretend that driver you hired for me in New York isn't CIA.
"He's not from the agency," Michael said. "He used to do some work for us from time to time."
"Does he carry a gun?"
"What difference does it make?"
"Answer me, does he carry a gun?"
"Yes, he carries a gun because I asked him to carry a gun."
"Jesus Christ," Elizabeth said, and turned off the light.
She climbed into bed and pulled the comforter beneath her chin. Michael lay next to her.
It's over, Michael. It's done.
It's not over as long as I know he's alive.
I almost lost you. I held you in my arms and prayed for you not to die after he shot you. I watched your blood running out of you. I don't want to go through that again.
Michael kissed her mouth, but her lips did not respond. He rolled over and closed his eyes. A match flared, and a moment later he smelled the smoke of Elizabeth's cigarette.
It's her, isn't it? It's Sarah Randolph. It's been more than 10 years, and you're still obsessed with her.
No, I'm not.
You're obsessed with avenging her death.
This has nothing to do with Sarah. It has to do with us. He tried to kill us, too.
You're a lousy liar, Michael.
She crushed out her cigarette in an ashtray on the bedside table and exhaled the last smoke sharply between her lips.
How you ever managed to function as a spy is beyond me.
The bedroom windows faced north and west, over Shelter Island Sound and Deering Harbor, so it was nearly 8 o'clock the following morning when they woke with the weak winter dawn. The children already were awake, and one of them, Michael was not certain which one, was crying. Elizabeth sat up, tore away her bedding, and swung her feet to the floor. She had slept poorly, troubled by nightmares, and her eyes were puffy and dark. She walked out of the room without speaking and went downstairs. He lay in bed for several minutes, listening to her coo at the children. After a moment he rose and went into the small sitting room off the bedroom. Douglas had left a vacuum thermos of coffee on the table with a folded copy of the New York Times. It was a weekend tradition at Cannon Point. Douglas always rose first and made coffee for everyone else in the house. Michael poured coffee and opened the newspaper. The West Bank had exploded in violence over the assassination of Ahmed Hussein. The Israeli government was threatening to send troops into Palestinian-controlled areas. The peace process was in critical condition. In Northern Ireland, a Protestant leader had been assassinated in Belfast. The Ulster Freedom Brigade had claimed responsibility. A half hour later, Michael found himself trudging along a frozen path through the Mashemack Nature Preserve. Douglas led the way along a narrow footpath threaded through bare trees. He was a tall, broad man, poorly designed for hiking, yet he nimbly negotiated the slippery trail. The previous night's rain had moved out to sea. A white sun shone in a sky streaked with cirrus clouds. It was intensely cold, and after a few minutes, Michael felt as though his lungs were filled with shattered glass. Winter had drained all color from the landscape. They came upon half a dozen white-tailed deer standing on their hind legs, stripping bark from the trees.
"Isn't that fantastic?" Douglas said.
He grew annoyed when Michael didn't concur. Michael found little beauty in nature. A secluded piazza in Venice gave him more pleasure than a Long Island bay. Woods and water bored him. People intrigued him because he mistrusted them, and he could outwit them if they threatened him. Michael told his father-in-law about the Ulster Freedom Brigade as they walked the stony shore of Smith Cove. Douglas Cannon allowed Michael to speak uninterrupted for 15 minutes, then he peppered him with questions for 10 more.
"I want a straight answer from you, Michael. Will I be in any physical danger if I accept this job?"
"The Ulster Freedom Brigade has shown its intentions very clearly. They want to punish every party to the peace accords. One major party remains, the Americans. Neither side, Republican or Loyalist, has ever intentionally killed an American. But the rules have changed.
20 years in Washington, and never once did I get a straight answer from a goddamn spook."
Even Michael had to laugh. "It's not an exact science. Intelligence estimates involve a good deal of conjecture and guesswork based on available evidence."
"Sometimes I think pulling petals from a daisy would be just as effective."
Douglas stopped walking and turned to face the water.
His face had turned crimson with the cold and wind. Smith Cove was the color of nickel. A half-empty ferry fought the strong current racing through the narrow channel between the southern tip of Shelter Island and North Haven Peninsula.
"Damn me for saying this, but I do want one more chance in the spotlight," Douglas said. "I could help make history, and that's pretty seductive for an old professor like me, even if it means working for a stupid son of a bitch like Jim Beckwith."
"Elizabeth is going to be furious."
"I'll deal with Elizabeth."
"Yeah, but I have to live with her."
"She's just like her mother, Michael. You never knew Eileen, but if you had, you'd understand where Elizabeth gets her stubbornness and her strength. If it hadn't been for Eileen, I would never have had the courage to leave Columbia and run for Congress."
Douglas kicked at the stones with the toe of his Wellington boot.
"You have a phone?"
Michael reached inside his coat pocket and handed Douglas a cellular telephone. Douglas dialed the president's office directly and left a message with Beckwith's personal secretary. They retraced their course, leaving the sunlight of Smith Cove for the cold shadows of the woods. 5 minutes later, the telephone chirped. Douglas, who was forever grappling with the complexities of modern communications, thrust the phone at Michael and said, "Answer this damn thing, will you?" Michael punched a button on the keypad and said, "Osborne."
"Good morning, Michael," said President James Beckwith. "I can't tell you how good it was to see you again last weekend. I'm pleased that you've made such a remarkable recovery. I just wish I could get you back at Langley, where you belong."
Michael resisted the impulse to warn the president that they were speaking on an insecure cell phone.
"Has your father-in-law reached a decision?"
"He has, Mr. President."
"Good news, I hope."
"I'll let him tell you." Michael handed the phone to Douglas and walked up the path a short distance so Douglas could speak to the president alone. Douglas flew to Washington that evening. He had told Elizabeth of his decision after returning from Mashemak Preserve. She absorbed the news with stoic restraint and gave him a cool, congratulatory kiss on the cheek, reserving her anger for Michael because he had failed to talk Douglas out of accepting the assignment. Michael accompanied Douglas to Washington for the ceremony. The two men stayed in Michael and Elizabeth's old red brick Federal on N Street and went to the White House the following morning. Douglas and Beckwith met in the Oval Office, drinking tea in wing chairs before a fire. Michael had wanted to wait outside, but the president insisted he join them. He sat down on one of the couches, a little apart from the others, and studied his hands while they talked. For 5 minutes, Douglas made the obligatory noises about loyalty and the honor of serving one's country. The president talked about the importance of the U.S.-British relationship and about the situation in Northern Ireland. At 10:30, the two men stepped through the French doors into the Rose Garden. It was a warm winter's day in Washington, the sun bright, the air soft, and the two men strode to the podium side by side, wearing suit jackets but no overcoats.
"Today I am proud to nominate former Senator Douglas Cannon of New York to be our next ambassador to the Court of St. James's in London," Beckwith said, matter-of-factly. "Douglas Cannon served the great state of New York and the American people brilliantly in both the House and the Senate, and I know firsthand he possesses the intellect, the strength, and the grace to represent this nation's interests in an important foreign capital such as London."
Beckwith turned and shook Douglas's hand as the small audience broke into applause. He held out his hand to the podium, and Douglas moved to the microphones.
"There will be many important issues in London, issues of trade and defense, but none more important now than helping the government of Prime Minister Blair to bring a lasting peace to Northern Ireland."
Douglas paused for a moment, looking past the audience directly into the television cameras.
"I have one thing to say to the men of violence, to those who wish to undo the Good Friday Accords. The days of the gun and the bomb and the balaclava are over. The people of Northern Ireland have spoken. Your day is done."
He paused a moment. "Mr. President, I look forward to serving you in London." XIII. Portadown, Northern Ireland.
"You hear the news this afternoon?" Kyle Blake asked as he sat down in his usual booth at McConville's pub.
"I did indeed," Gavin Spencer said. "The man has a big mouth."
"Can we get to him?" Blake said to no one in particular.
"If we can get to Eamon Dillon, we can get to an American ambassador," Gavin Spencer said. "But does it serve our purposes?"
"The Americans haven't paid a price for their support of the Good Friday Accords," Blake said. "If we're able to assassinate the American ambassador, everyone in the States will know who we are and what we're about. Remember, we're not trying to win a battlefield victory. We're trying to win publicity for our cause. If we kill Douglas Cannon, the entire American media will be forced to tell the story of Ulster from the Protestant perspective. It's like a reflex action. That's what they do. It worked for the IRA, and it worked for the PLO. But can it really be done?"
"We can do it any number of ways," Spencer said. "We need just one thing. We need to know when and where. We need intelligence on his movements, his whereabouts. We have to choose our opportunity carefully, or it won't work."
Blake and Spencer looked at Rebecca Wells. Blake said, "Can you get us the kind of information we'll need?"
"Without question," Rebecca said. "I'll need to go to London. I'll need a flat, some money, and most of all, plenty of time. Information like this doesn't come overnight."
Blake took a long pull from his Guinness while he thought it all through. After a moment, he looked up at Rebecca.
"I want you to set up shop in London as soon as possible. I'll get you the money in the morning."
He turned to Gavin. "Start preparing your team. They're not to be told the target until it's absolutely necessary. And tread softly. Both of you. Tread very softly."
February. 14. New York City.
"How was London?" Adrian Carter asked. They had entered Central Park at 90th Street and 5th Avenue, and were walking the cinder and dirt footpath on the levee surrounding the reservoir. Freezing winds stirred the leafless tree limbs above their heads. Near the banks of the reservoir, the water had frozen. But a short distance from shore, in a patch of mercury-colored water, a flotilla of ducks bobbed like tiny vessels at anchor.
"How did you know I was in London?" Michael asked.
"Because British intelligence sent me a polite note asking if your visit was business or pleasure. I told them you were retired, so it was surely pleasure, was I right?"
"Depends on your definition of pleasure," Michael said, and Carter laughed mildly.
Adrian Carter was the chief of the CIA's counter-terrorism center. He had served as Michael's control officer when Michael was working in the field. Even now, they moved as though they were meeting behind enemy lines. Carter walked like a man wrestling with an eternally guilty conscience, shoulders hunched, hands thrust deep into his pockets. His large, droopy eyes gave him the appearance of perpetual fatigue, yet they flickered constantly around the trees and the reservoir, and across the faces of the joggers foolish enough to brave the biting cold. He wore an ugly woolen ski hat that robbed him of any physical authority. His pudgy down jacket created a floating effect, so he seemed to be blowing along the footpath with the wind. Strangers tended to underestimate Carter, which he had used to his advantage throughout his career, both in the field and in the bureaucratic trenches at headquarters. He was a brilliant linguist, he dreamed in a half-dozen languages, and he had lost count of the countries where he had operated.
"So what the hell were you doing in London?" Carter asked.
Michael told him. Carter said, "Pick up anything interesting?" Michael told Carter what he had learned during his meeting with Graham Seymour without divulging the source. Typically, Carter didn't indicate whether any of the information was news to him. He was like that even with Michael. The office wits in the CTC used to say that Carter would rather face torture than volunteer where he had eaten lunch.
"And what brings you to New York?" Michael asked.
"Some business at New York Station.
Carter stopped speaking as a pair of joggers, a young woman and an older man, pounded past. A little housekeeping that needed to be done in person, and I wanted to see you.
Why?
Jesus Christ, Michael. We've known each other 20 years, Carter said, with the amiable irritation that in him passed for anger. I didn't think there was anything wrong with dropping by for a chat while I was in town.
So why are we walking in the park in 20-degree weather?
I have an aversion to closed, unswept rooms. They reached the clock in the old pumping station at the southern end of the reservoir. A group of tourists speaking German with Viennese accents were posing for pictures. Michael and Carter turned reflexively, like a pair of synchronized swimmers, and crossed a wooden footbridge. A moment later, they were walking along the park drive behind the Metropolitan Museum.
That was awfully nice of the Senate to send Douglas off to London with a unanimous confirmation vote, Carter said.
He was surprised. He thought that at least one of his old Republican adversaries would want to spoil the party. Carter put his gloved hands to his mouth and exhaled heavily to warm his face, which had gone crimson with the cold. Carter was a habitual golfer, and winters depressed him.
"But you didn't come here to discuss Douglas, did you, Adrian?"
Carter removed his hand from his face and said, "Actually, I was wondering when you were going to come back to work. I need you in the CTC."
"Why do you need me all of a sudden?"
"Because you're one of those rare birds who can move effortlessly between headquarters and the field. For very selfish reasons, I want you back on my team."
"Sorry, Adrian, but I'm out, and I intend to stay out. Life's good."
"You're bored out of your mind, and if you tell me otherwise, you're a liar." Michael stopped and turned to face Carter, anger on his face. "How dare you fucking come here and—"
"All right," Carter said. Perhaps my choice of words was inappropriate. "But what the hell have you been doing with yourself all these months?"
"I've been taking care of my family, spending time with my children, and trying to act like a normal human being for the first time in my adult life."
"Any job prospects?"
"Not really."
"Do you ever intend to go back to work?"
"I'm not sure," Michael said. "I have no real job experience because the company I worked for was a CIA front, and I'm barred from telling a potential employer what I really did for a living."
"Why not come home?"
"Because it didn't feel much like home the last time I visited."
"Let's put that all behind us and start over again.
Did you learn that line in one of those employee management seminars at Personnel?"
Carter stopped walking. "The director is coming to New York tonight. Your presence has been requested at dinner."
"I have plans."
"Michael, the director of the Central Intelligence Agency would like to have dinner with you. Surely you can put aside your arrogance and make a little time in your busy schedule."
"I'm sorry, Adrian, but you're wasting your time, and so is the director. I'm just not interested. It was good seeing you, though. Give my love to Christine and the children."
Michael turned and started walking.
"If you want out so badly, why did you go to Cairo?" Carter said. "You went to Cairo because you think October is still alive, and frankly, so do I."
Michael turned around.
Carter said, "I guess I finally got your attention."
This ends Disc 3.